Hello, and welcome to Life Beyond the Numbers, the podcast for people who are curious about how to have a more fulfilling work life. We live in a world largely driven by numbers, logic, and reason. But how we feel at work and about our work impacts us, our organizations, and society. There is a relationship between the numbers of our organizations and the life beyond the numbers. I'm Susan Mikhrilon, your host. I've lived and worked in many countries. I've met people who love what they do and people who don't, people who bring their full selves to work and people who won't. But one thing that I've learned that is common to us all is that we are all unique and have unique experiences. And it's helpful to know that there are others who think like we do, or have had struggles too, or have gone where we want to go, or can show us things we didn't know. So join me and my guests as we place a lens on the human side of work life by sharing insights, stories, and strategies to inspire you to let your uniqueness shine. Well, today I am delighted to welcome Andy Brown to Life Beyond the Numbers. Andy, you're so welcome.
Thank you, Susan. And can I just say straight from the off that I loved your discussion about stereotypes on your last podcast. I'm very curious about the world. Do you know where stereotype comes from? Do you know where the word comes from?
I don't.
The stereotype was originally used in French for, it was a type of printing. And the printing, the stereotype would mean that it would produce the same thing again and again, hence the printing and the stereotype. They would always look the same. And then, so stereotype was the block you would print from, but cliche, which is something that's repeated and repeated and repeated and becomes boring, cliche comes from the same thing, which is as the ink was rolled across the stereotype, it made a noise, which the French called a cliche. The noise it makes is, I don't know if you ever had anything to do with printing ink, it's very sticky. And a cliche is the noise it makes. And that's the word the French had. So stereotype and cliche are completely related. And as I was listening to your stereotypes of actuaries, I thought, well, I wonder if Susan knows that. So I thought I'd share that with you. Sorry if it's a bit off topic straight away.
No. And I love that, especially as we're going to talk about books and printing in a moment. But stereotypes and cliche, wow, I did not know that. And it reminds me of, I studied nationalism and ethnic conflict for a year, 12, 13 years ago now. And one of the things I learned a lot about was stereotypes and how we other people all the time. Mm. And so I decided, took it upon myself to try and not use stereotypes at all for, I don't know, let's say 2 weeks. And I think I got about 3 hours through the day because we do use them so much. We're not even conscious of the stereotypes, but then they're just shortcuts for our brain.
And we're going to talk about emotional overdraft today, I hope. But that's what emotional overdraft is. It's a label. So my background is marketing, but I've written this book, The Emotional Overdraft, and we'll get into what it's about and what it means. But I just thought if we had a label for this state that people are in, it's a shorthand, it's a brand. A brand is a shorthand for a lot of things. So Heinz baked beans, you know that they're going to be of a certain price, of a certain quality, they get a certain amount of availability, they won't be tampered with, they've been made in a certain way. It's Heinz baked beans is a shorthand, it's a brand for a load of things you understand about that thing. So I think the idea of a stereotype is we gravitate towards them as humans. We like shorthands. We like labels. And it's not surprising. And we shouldn't use them glibly, but they occur for a reason.
They do. They do. As long as we can check that reason every now and then, we're okay.
Yeah. And when it becomes weaponized as well, that's the thing. It's very easy to weaponize a label. And I was talking to a psychologist about emotional overdraft, and she said, my worry about this sort of labeling is that it can become weaponized like burnout did. A little while ago, you'd get people who go, I'm completely burnt out, but I'm pushing through. I'm manning up. There's a cliche for you. I'm manning up and I'm pushing through. And it's like a badge of honor. And so we have to be careful these labels don't become those things. So it's an interesting conversation about labels.
It is, and the culture that we have now as well, I think there's a lot of labeling of things that maybe are mislabeling or overusing the label, like burnout, because I think if you are really burnt out, you cannot push through. There's also,
No.
so there are things that we misuse by shortcutting to that label, and that's dangerous as well, because I think then we're in the territory of the boy who cried wolf.
Yes. Well, my favorite current example I immediately think of when you said that was iconic. It's become a word that is totally ubiquitous at the moment, and it used to mean something of iconographic status that was so well known and so unarguable. Now it just means quite good. It means all right. It was an iconic sandwich. You think there can't be an iconic sandwich. Just don't be, but there it is. And my industry advertising is sort of partly to blame, but it is, everyone's using it everywhere all the time. And it's not the correct use of the word, and it's not helpful. We're lazy. We look for shortcuts. Humans look for shortcuts, and we find a word that seems to fit and we use it.
As somebody said to me once, we're gloomy, lazy predictors because we're negative because we're looking for the risk in things to survive. We're lazy because of the shortcuts and we're predicting what's coming next. I remind myself of that at times, that we
Best
can
avoided,
be
I'd say.
best
Best avoided.
avoided.
Let's be hermits.
Hermits, no. But let's shake the gloomy and the lazy for shaking it up. Now, I've read your book, Emotional Overdraft, and I really enjoyed it, Andy. So thank you for
Thank
writing
you.
it and putting it out into the world. And we'll talk about it as we go through. But one of the things I wonder where not so much the idea, first of all, but even writing the book came from. And I saw a line in the book that just spoke to me, which was a favorite saying of your father's, which you heard all the time growing up. Where there's muck, there's brass. And I guess a lot of us go through things in life and we can pull the lessons out of them. And that's what I thought about when I read that line. And I wondered if bringing emotional overdraft to life was from the muck in your own life that this is the brass, without putting words in your mouth.
No, I love that you've seen it that way. And I also love this conversation. We just went straight into stereotypes and cliches, and we're off and running. Susan and I barely know each other, but it does feel like we've been having this conversation for the last 10 years, which is fantastic. Yeah, my father was very northern. He was very Lancastrian, self-educated, fabulous man, left school at 14, did incredibly well for himself. But that old northern expression, where there's muck, there's brass, was something he really believed. At one level, he meant the rag and bone man. At another level, he definitely meant chaos and disorganization, and there's the potential to organize. And I suppose I'm very curious. If I had to sort of pin down what defines me, is curiosity. And when I ran agencies, I used to talk to my teams or new people, new starters, and I'd say, what I'm looking for is curiosity. I want someone that's walking along and notices the rock, notices the stone. And I want someone who not just notices the stone, but I want someone who picks the stone up to see what's underneath it. That's the curiosity I want. And ideally, maybe you're the person that then just licks the stone, maybe just to see what it tastes like. I want people who are that curious in the world. And it's that curiosity is what gets me rummaging in the mud and the muck, I think. And definitely somewhere in my mind with emotional overdraft, which is about an emotional overdraft, is the way that founders and entrepreneurs and leaders subsidize a business at the cost of their own mental or physical reserves. And that can be very unhealthy and very damaging. And I think I saw it again and again and again in lots of different ways. And I never really defined it. I never really kind of found a, it didn't really coalesce, but I saw the output, which was people running businesses who asked a question and the answer was always, I'll do it. Or I can fix it. So the answer was the thing that I saw everywhere. That was the mess. And until I really stopped to think about it and to research it, I just wondered if it was something I was seeing, or if it was just something that I was causing, because my job is to help business leaders and I'm an advisor and non-exec, or which it, thank goodness, wasn't. what I ended up spotting in the research I carried out was that it's universal. Anyone who runs a team, anyone who runs a business, anyone who has investment in an organization, personal investment, to a greater or less extent, subsidizes that business at their own cost. And what the research showed was the 10 drivers behind that. So that's when it started to coalesce. And I had this sort of tentative name, emotional overdraft, which is, I like the idea of the emotional and the feelings, the idea of feelings and the rational monetary and overdraft component mashing together. And people really responded to it. And at that point, I thought, well, then I'm onto something here, because it's a label that works for people. It's pretty universal. I've got some points of view around how you can do something about it, because it is not inevitable. And that's, I suppose, if it's not brass, because you don't make money writing a book, as you will soon discover, you're not doing it for the money. I'm genuinely doing it because I'm ancient and I wanted to share it. I think this is something that's valuable to people. I think if you know someone who runs a company, you will recognize that self-sacrifice that they make, that they believe is inevitable, and it really isn't inevitable. That's the point. And if I can help people realize that, just by recognizing it in the moment, if they just recognize it in the moment, it will get easier, because they'll take a pause and they'll maybe do something differently. And or they can then, there's a self-assessment on my website if they want to go and do it. You know, spoiler alert, you have an emotional overdraft, so that won't be the surprise. It's how big it is and how often you stay in it. You can do something about this. And that's the brass, that's the payoff for me in this, is if someone, and people contact me and say, this is so helpful, this is just so blinking useful.
That's brilliant. And I think the term emotional overdraft, it's something you came up with, right? It's a term you came up with when I read the explanation you gave, or when you explain it just now. It's like I've known it all my life.
Mm.
I just didn't have a term for it. And I think that's quite incredible, to be able to capture something, give it a term, and I can just go, yeah, that's what that was. Because you did talk about how you got to the concept, the title, you know, the research you did, Andy, contacting 141 coaches and asking them questions. Maybe you talk a little bit.
Yeah, I'm a coach, and as well as a non-exec and advisor. So it's hard to differentiate what's what. They blur into the same thing, really. One minute I'm a psychologist and the next minute I'm holding their feet to the fire. The people who have the best insight into what leaders, let's call them leaders, but what I mean is people who run business, people who run teams, people who set up businesses. Although I do think emotional overdraft is a universal, it's a definitely universal challenge. But other coaches, and I know a lot of coaches and from my network, and had this conversation and spoke to a lot of coaches about what was the biggest challenge they were dealing with. And these are coaches who are dealing with CEOs of Fortune 500 companies and CEOs of small businesses, which is where I tend to work, and everything in between. And without fail, the response was burnout or overwhelm. Without fail. And there's lots and lots of different reasons for it, but it's the rapid change that's going on around us, the change in how you run a business, the change in the expectations of staff, the change in expectations post-lockdown. The scale of change is unprecedented. In fact, there's been quite a lot of writing about it subsequently, but the invisible damage that was done was not really to people at either end of this. It wasn't to shareholders and it wasn't to the people who were working, although we all dealt with that in our own ways. The invisible damage was done to this management layer, who were people that had to reinvent their job as they on the fly and keep their teams happy and motivated and engaged, who were wrestling themselves with what their job now meant. And it's hardly surprising that that's overwhelming, that becomes just unmanageable. And if you then go, well, I'm in a small business, it's my own business, or I'm a shareholder in that business, or if you run a team in a small business, you're tantamount to the owner. Then what you do is you start going, well, then I'll work harder. I'll do more. Or worse, you don't do that, but you start drawing on other people's emotional overdrafts, your people around you. It really does ripple out. So there are people who I've spoken to who go, I don't have an emotional overdraft. And I say, but what about your partner? What about your kids? How do they feel about the amount of effort you're putting in? I run a business. I expect to behave this way. This is what I expect. It's always like that. It isn't always like that. And even if you're not feeling it, your staff might be feeling it. They might be subsidizing you through their emotional overdraft, which is even worse. Or your partner, or your kids, or your social network, or your community, or your health. And these are the things where it draws from. It will draw from somewhere. Energy moves, and this is what happens, and it's insidious. I would have called it the pandemic if we hadn't had a real pandemic. And without wanting it to be a cliche, I couldn't help myself. I'm such a child. But it almost does feel like that. It's so widespread. It's so universal. It's so damaging. The cost is so big. And the sense is that you can't do anything about it. This feeling that, well, it's inevitable. But that's just not true. It's just not true. What the research threw up with these 10 drivers, I called them, but they're sort of 10 behaviors, which are typical of people who create an emotional overdraft for themselves. And I say create it for themselves because it all happens in our own thinking. So we live in the world we create in our own brains. And it's so hard to understand that. It's so easy to say it and so hard to grasp. But these 10 behaviors, to a greater or less extent, cover the whole gamut of reasons why people would do this. And what do this being end up with an emotional overdraft?
Yeah, and we'll get to some of those a bit later, Andy. But first, like what you said about the hidden cost. Now, I think this is a huge thing that probably needs not more work from you per se, but the fact that it is a hidden cost, it doesn't hit a profit and loss account, it doesn't hit the balance sheet. So there isn't a measurement per se, or a metric, or a number that somebody can put on this. And then
that's exactly right.
We tend to run from it then and hide from it. So if it's invisible, well, then it doesn't matter.
Or if it's invisible, it isn't real.
It isn't real. Yeah, exactly. And the people you were talking about are, I know a lot of those people. I probably am one of those people who we've tended to put our own needs in the back burner. And there'll be time when, or I'll get to that when. And the hidden cost is not so hidden, really. It's just not monetary. And even then, it probably is because we get sick and we're off work and whatever.
And then you can measure it. But talking to an accountant, I'm not surprised the invisible line in the P&L, the profit and loss, is something that appealed, because I get so frustrated with my clients when they talk about, we start our board meetings with what they call the numbers or the financials. And I keep saying to people, we have to think of this as management information, or management intelligence is what I'd rather call it. It's intelligence that informs our decision making. And part of that is your financials or the numbers, but there's numbers that aren't in there as well. And emotional overdraft could be one of those things. And I think that's what coaches are telling me, is suddenly we've got something now we can label and we can measure. Everyone's emotional overdraft is different. The currency of an emotional overdraft is your resilience, and it damages your resilience. So you become less and less able to bounce back. Everyone's ability to levels of resilience are different. So we can't say it is precisely this or something else, but we can work on an index. We can say, if it was 100 yesterday, what is it today? Has it gone up? Has our overdraft gone up? Are we deeper in debt, or has it gone down? And across a month, we can track it. So it definitely is monitorable. And that's a piece of management information. And the way I describe it in the book is, I say, I sat in so many meetings. I sat in a meeting where people actually massaged the figures. An accountant, imagine them massaging the figures. But they had 11 months in the year where they made a profit. And then in the middle of the year, they lost about £900. It was nothing. It was pretty much break even. But they wanted to have, for their own satisfaction, 12 months of profit. And then on the bottom right-hand corner, there was their profit figure for the year. And they massaged those figures and they got a profit for every month, because you can move the numbers around. It doesn't really matter to a great extent. Sorry if the Inland Revenue are listening. But within the year, it didn't matter too much to them. But the number that was missing was the cost that they had paid as a leadership team to generate that profit. So let's say they've made £10,000 in the year, made up number. You could take off that the personal cost that they had paid through their emotional overdrafts, And there isn't a monetary figure we can put on that, but we could definitely have tracked month on month on month, were they trading in an overdraft or not, individually and as a team? And then we might look at that £10,000 number profit and say, well, that isn't the real profit. The real profit is that less the personal cost we've paid. And setting aside the human individual component of that, that's a business that isn't sustainable because you can't continue to drive your business with more and more overdraft drawn from your team because good people leave, or we get burnout, or we get overwhelmed, we get stress, background stress, we get reductions in productivity, all those things that are actually quite hard to measure until people go sick. So I think there is, I describe it as an invisible line in the P&L because it is there. It's a cost line, but we just don't acknowledge it. And so we can kid ourselves about our P&L. We can kid ourselves about our profitability and move numbers around a little bit. But what we absolutely have to look at is what's the personal cost? Added to which, it's not good. It's not good business practice. It is much, you know, if you took that £10,000 and said, how would we build a sustainable business? Well, let's reduce that by 100. Let's make it £100,000. Let's reduce that by £50,000, and we'd had one more member of staff. How much less would those people have been damaged? How much more could we have done? And I go into specifics, but everyone can think of examples where a founder will say, "I think I might have mentioned it in the book." I remember that they budgeted £4,000 a month for a new hire, and they didn't hire them for 3 months. And at the end of those 3 months, there was £12,000 more on the bottom line. And they were celebrating, going, isn't that great? We've got this profitability. We've got this money that we've retained in the business. I said, but at what cost? Why did you want to hire someone in the first place? And it was because your client teams are stretched beyond their capabilities. We didn't have the skills we needed in-house, so we're outsourcing to expensive freelancers. Your clients are getting unhappy because they don't feel loved and getting the attention they need. So yes, you've saved £12,000, but there's a reason we wanted to hire someone. So we saved a little bit of money, but what damage have we done to the business and what damage have we done to our people? It's getting a bit accounting now, isn't it? Sorry about that.
No, but
I was apologizing to everyone listening. I know you love it, Susan.
People will enjoy it. They'll hear the enjoyment in our voices. But what I mean, like, we can't make profit at any cost. I firmly believe that we cannot make profit at any cost.
But it's not profit.
It's not profit, no, but there's a vanity about it, I think. And there is a, perhaps the environment or the world we live in is all about profit. So we don't hear about companies that are loss making. And actually, companies can survive loss making. What they can't survive, and I think this comes to the overdraft, is without cash, which is the resilience of the business. And an emotional overdraft is absolutely that. We cannot survive without our own resilience, and we're doing the damage. So I wonder, Andy, this, like, the emotional, the word emotional, even on a book cover, for, you said you were, I don't know what the word you used, I won't say ancient, but you said something like that at the beginning. For a man in his later, well, I won't say later life, that sounds terrible. I mean, you're a bit older than me.
I'm 58.
Okay,
I'm 58.
There you go.
Let's give it a number.
And I'm 50, so we're in the same decade. To approach that and have the word emotional, how is that viewed by people who may want to stay away from that word? And you talk about the rational and the emotional, and I totally get that because I would come from the same viewpoint or standpoint, but it isn't widely talked about. So emotions, or that term.
So are you emotional. Asking me, why is a man talking about emotions? Is that what you said?
Well, I'm asking you why you are, not just any man, but you.
Okay. All right. Okay. I'm just, since we're avoiding stereotypes, let's just, yeah. It's a great question. I've always believed in, well, I don't believe in it because it's a fact, but I've always been an advocate for authenticity. I think authenticity is a superpower. My daughter just would laugh at me then. But I do think it's a superpower because it makes you more believable. People, we can smell authenticity a mile away. Part of authenticity is being prepared to be vulnerable and being prepared to risk sharing things. So in the book, I talk about, you know, when I was running my own business and I'd come home and I'd be shattered and worried and stressed. And when my kids were really small, I'd sort of just climb into bed and cuddle the kids and cry. It was awful when I look back. I mean, it's making me feel a bit emotional now. I look back and think, why were you allowing that, Andy? Why did you let yourself get to that place? But I was running my own business and I had people, my staff had mortgages to pay, and you tell yourself these stories. And it has to be me that fixes it. And I wish I read my own book 20 years ago. But talking about emotions, feelings I tend to talk about more than emotions, but I think emotions are something that people can relate to more easily. And lovely Brené Brown, who my dream dinner party guest, not a relative, wrote a book fairly recently. One of, I think it might be her most recent book, was called Atlas of the Heart. And I think it was something like 87 words. She described 87 words for emotions, because her argument is that ask someone to define their emotions, they go happy, sad, angry, frustrated, and they grind to a halt. And we have a lot of words for negative emotions and not so many for positive emotions. So she was arguing that if we have more dictionary for emotional words, we have the ability to explain more accurately how we're feeling, or to recognize how we're feeling, and then we can do something about it. So René Loisu, who's an absolutely brilliant three principles coach I've worked with, she talks about your feelings are a measure of the quality of your thinking. And if I had a tattoo, that's what I'd have. Your feelings are the measure of the quality of your thinking is such a brilliant, brilliant thing. And for anyone listening, what that means is if you're feeling frustrated, if you're feeling angry, if you're feeling irritated, if you're feeling happy for that matter, that's a good measure of what quality of thinking is going on in your brain in that moment. And emotions are very, very, very tightly related to your thinking. So they're a manifestation of it. And she goes on to say that then your feelings dictate your behaviors, which dictate your outcomes, which is true as well. So your feelings are this manifestation of your thinking. So if your feelings are off, you know that your thinking is probably not as clear as it could be. So it's a really good sense checker. So for me, it makes complete sense to think about emotions. It makes complete sense to talk about feelings. We don't do it enough. And again, go back to that board meeting with the management intelligence. I always ask my clients how they're feeling. I always encourage them to talk to their staff about how they're feeling, because how you feel is the reality of what they're actually experiencing. Whatever you intended, whatever you said and meant, what they felt is how they experienced what you said. And that's human connection, that fabulous Carol Robbins Connect, an amazing book from the Harvard Business School about, they call it the touchy-feely course. It's the most oversubscribed course on the Harvard MBA. And Carol Robbins, and I've forgotten the name of the co-writer, run this course. All they do is they talk about how you connect with other people. But its nickname is the touchy-feely course. It's the most oversubscribed course on the Harvard MBA. So
Wow.
that tells you emotions and feelings are mainstream thinking for business leaders now. Not yet for everybody. It's coming. It's definitely coming. So I don't think I'm in the vanguard, but we should talk about it more. We should absolutely talk about it more. It's one of the best indicators of so much, really. I don't even know if that answered the question. Sorry.
It doesn't really matter. I mean,
Okay.
and you have. And I think there's a couple of things, because it speaks to the labeling that we talked about earlier, because I think there is something very powerful about labeling what you're feeling, and not with just those five shortcuts, stereotypical words that we use, but actually looking for the word, or even just describing it. You don't have to have one word, you can have a few words. And it takes the power away somehow as well by labeling and by having that
Well, and by
explanation.
awareness, isn't it? It's the awareness.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
being aware of it in the moment changes your relationship to it.
Yes,
It loses its power. Like you said,
yes.
it loses its power in the moment because you've gone, oh, that's one of those. You almost stepped back and gone, okay, that's that. I'm getting angry. Well, why is that? What's my thinking? And that's when you suddenly get the power back.
And you can do that for yourself. So that's powerful as well.
Yes.
And the other thing I thought about was this book I love is Permission to Feel by Professor Mark Brackett. I don't know if it's one you've read, but
No, but I'm going to scribble it down.
it's a really good book. And he talks about yourself, your children, and in the workplace. He takes you through three different places. And again, it's the same. We need to be able to talk about this because feelings matter at work. And my own book, the premise of that is that if feelings matter at work and they're not on the P&L or in the balance sheet, but actually the results are. So the results, and this is kind of what you're saying, the results could be better if everybody felt better.
Yes, absolutely right. I'll say it again then. Your thinking drives your feeling, which drives the behaviors, which drive your outcomes.
Exactly.
Undoubtedly true. Your
Yeah.
feelings drive your behaviors. We know this. This is where all the manifestation and all those other good, clever things. You get up in the morning and you feel you're going to have a miserable day and you dread all the meetings you've got to have and you're worried about whether your kids will pass their exams or whatever it is. Your day will end up being a tough old day. If you get up and go, today I'm going to really take it head on and I'm going to, bring my positive energy and my best game. If you've got 40% capacity energy today and you use all that 40%, then you've given 100% that day. You've given everything you've got and recognize that, then that's okay. And that's great. And you can literally change the outcomes of the day. I was talking to someone yesterday about skiing. I don't ski. Very bad knees. I blame rugby. But apparently, when you're skiing through woods, if you focus on the gaps between the trees, so picture this now, you're with me zipping down this hill between the trees, very James Bond-like. If you focus on the gaps between the trees and you can moderately good skier, you will hit the gaps between the trees and you will go between them. If you focus on not hitting the trees, you will hit the trees because your brain is going trees, 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 and you will just go as close to them as you can. If you want to hit the gaps, you'll hit the gaps. If you say avoid the trees, you'll hit the trees. Someone we both know, Alison, our publisher, she's run over 2,000 consecutive days. And what she did was she flipped her thinking from being, I try to run every day, to I'm someone who runs every day. And she just reframed it slightly. And the difference between someone who runs every day and someone who tries to run every day is that one doesn't have permission not to. And so she finds a way to run every day. And her rules are I pull on my sneakers and I run 2K. Fabulous. And that's a simple, it's her brain. She's created it in her own head. And she's done over 6 years or whatever, 2000, you can tell me quicker than that. She's done 6 years or so of never missing a run. That's incredible.
It
And
is.
she runs a business and she's busy. And like the rest of us, I should go walking today and it's pouring with rain in Dorset and I'm not going to.
And she's helping her emotional overdraft by running
Undoubtedly,
every
she is.
day. Yeah, because she's looking after herself, which is what matters when you're running a business. So I'd
It
like
does.
to,
And we sacrifice it. Yeah.
yeah, we do, we sacrifice it. I'd love to go into some of the drivers, Andy, before we run out of time, because they are really important. But of course, people can buy the book and read it and learn them for themselves. But there are 10 drivers. And I think the first two in particular really struck me, which is, well, trust, first of all. So maybe you'd speak a little to that one.
Trust is a huge, huge drive. So the way the book works is I took the front half I talk about, and this is where editors come in, by the way. If you're thinking about writing a book, find yourself a good editor. The front half talks about emotional overdraft, what it is, how we have it, how we recognize it. The second half of the book is what can you do about these 10 drivers? How can you make some small, simple changes to change your behavior? So that's really what we're talking about here. And trust is, it's a challenge for every founder, I think. It's one of the ones that indexes high for a lot of people often. And it's because a business is your baby. When you start, it's you or you and a couple of people, and you can do everything and you know what's going on and you know all the clients and you know everything about it. Trust isn't a problem. The moment you start having a few more people in that business where you're not necessarily talking to all the clients, you're not doing all the new business, you're not on top of everything, you have to be able to trust the people around you. And founders find that really difficult. They find it very hard to let go. And it's quite a big chapter because there's an awful lot going on. And I am by no means an expert in this. And just sorry, just to go back to a point you made about this is something that needs a lot more work. I'm not the person to do that. I'm happy for people to take this away and go, emotional overdraft is something I can really work with and I can take somewhere else. I think it is important. So I encourage people to take this idea and take it where they want to take it because it's definitely worth that. But going back to trust. So, for example, if you don't trust your team to do things, what inevitably happens is that you just get dragged back into every decision. If you get dragged back into every decision, Well, you're not going to have time. You're going to get frustrated. One of the behaviors is that your team, there's some incredible self-fulfilling prophecy where if you keep stepping back in, your team will go, well, the boss will step in and fix it. So what you happen, you create an inert workforce, and then your emotional overdraft goes into overdrive because it goes, well, I've hired a load of people that don't do anything. They rely on me for everything. You've created that. So not only does an emotional overdraft occur through lack of trust, but also your business starts getting damaged, and then people start behaving differently. And then being the founder, being the leader, you step in and do more, and then you get more and more frustrated and your overdrive goes up again and again. It's this awful thing that feeds on itself. I think it's quite important to say that all of the drivers that I've identified are both positive and negative. It's like SWOT analysis at college. It's easy to do a SWOT analysis. You do the strengths and you do the opportunities, and then the weaknesses and threats write themselves. They're just the opposite. And I think with the 10 drivers, it blindly trusting people would be a foolish thing to do. And you said earlier on, we're hard-coded as humans. That's our monkey brain, isn't it? Going, we need to survive and avoid the saber-toothed tiger. So I think trust is both a brilliant thing and also a dangerous thing. And I recognize that if you trust people too much, or you give people too much responsibility too soon, or if you don't train them properly, they will fail. But you want a culture where failure is acceptable, at least not repeated failure, but you want a culture where failure is acceptable, because you want people pushing the edges of these things. You want people going to the edge and seeing what failure looks like. You don't want people sitting comfortably in the middle. But a really good example of a driver that people say, well, why is that? And particularly if you do the self, there's a self-assessment. I call it the Cosmo quiz for people of a certain age. That, you know, I had a sister a bit younger than me, and she used to read Cosmo, Cosmopolitan magazine, that is. And there'd be a 50 tick list, yes, no tick list to decide if he was your perfect boyfriend type of thing. And I've done this really for promotional overdraft and put it online. But within that, there's some questions in there about empathy. And they go, well, empathy is a good thing in a leader. So why is empathy on the list? And empathy is a brilliant thing. It's in short supply and it's an amazing thing. But equally, if you over-empathize, you end up being a really good example in my research of a guy who never went on holiday. He had two young kids. But all his staff had kids, all of a certain age. And so he would work through the half terms, or he would work through the holidays so they could have time off to see their kids. And I said to him, what on earth are you doing? Why? You have no relationship with your children. What's it doing to them? And he was really upset. He said, I know that. I know that this is damaging my relationship with my kids, and you don't get this time back. But what else can I do? And I said, go on holiday. Talk to your teams. Organize it so you take it in turns. And I said, speak to the team. Following week, we spoke again, and he said, I spoke to the team about it, and they all thought I was bonkers. They said, why aren't you taking holidays? We assumed something was wrong. So empathy is a brilliant thing, but not if it's misapplied, not if it's applied at your own expense, not if it's damaging you. It should be empathy so that the feelings that people take from conversations with you are empowering and energizing and motivating and exciting. That's where empathy comes into its own, not when it's you sacrificing everything because you want your team. It's the difference between being kind and being nice. Being nice is indulgent. Being kind is the right thing to do. Clarity is kindness, is one of my expressions. If you're clear with people, that's the kind thing to do. They know what they're dealing with. People don't mind bosses who are, I nearly said a-holes. They don't mind bosses who are not very pleasant. What people like is consistency. They really want consistency. They know what they're dealing with then. They know how to manage that around that. So I think, yeah, empathy is a very good example of the yin and the yang of these things, really, which is, so I'm not saying any of these things is a bad thing. I mean, on the list of, it's things like urgency, or JFDI is another one. Just flip and do it, as I was told to call it, because they're not allowed to give it its real name in the book. That's for the precious Americans who worry about what flipping might really mean. But if you're a doer, if you're someone who just gets stuff done, and again, you're not allowed to say what that is either. So if you just get things done, you're a doer. That's great when you're starting a company. And it's great generally. Everyone loves a doer. But there are loads of things that are damaging about doers. It undermines your team. It removes autonomy from people. It stops you doing the things you should be doing, probably. You're into the micro when you should be in the macro. They talk about working on the business, not in the business. There's all sorts of behavior changes that it will stop you. So JFDI in itself is not a bad thing. When it's applied correctly, it's great. When it's not applied correctly, it's extremely limiting for a business, and it's extremely bad for your emotional overdraft. So as ever, there's two sides to this thing. And that's why I say it's about simple changes. They're not easy, but they're simple changes in behavior that can completely change your relationship with your emotional overdraft.
And what I like about the book as well, Andy, is I think anyone can read this and understand it. I don't think you have to be a business owner or even work in a company that's owned by one person per se. I think it applies anywhere, because what I found myself doing as I read through it was applying it back to when I was in positions of responsibility in organizations and seeing it in others as well. And micromanagement, for example, which we talk about a lot in the workplaces today, fits nicely into the trust piece and other places as well. So I think it is a book that anyone in a workplace could read and benefit from. I went to do the self-assessment, and because I don't have employees, I felt, okay, this doesn't really apply to me. However, you can read it in the book and look at the ones that bother you or are in your realm, because I think there's a lot of people in workplaces today. I mean, look at the statistics of how many are disengaged. This book could help people to come out of that, or to see where their bosses are coming from or their managers are coming from. So I think there's a wider audience, perhaps, which is a good thing, than you originally wrote it for.
Thank you for saying that. I totally agree. The reason I wrote it in a more narrow audience is because if you're writing a book, you need an audience. And so you need to be able to go, well, these are the people. My background is leadership coaching, non-execing, running teams. So it was natural for me to go there. I do think this is a universal challenge. Even if you're not working, it's a behavioral thing. I can't remember. I just share this example so often, but Saturday afternoon, you've had a long week. You want to flop down on the sofa at home, watch Strictly Come Dancing with a takeaway curry. I'm entirely protecting my own personal desires. That is me. I'm sorry. I will admit it. But you know, and then a friend phones up and goes, are you coming out tonight, Andy? It's going to be great. We haven't seen you for ages. And you go, yeah, okay, I'll come out. And you go out and you probably have a good time. But the problem is, what you really needed to do was to unplug, probably not talk to anyone for a while, not bother cooking, treat yourself, whatever it was. And you haven't. And you've sacrificed that. And there's been some emotional cost to you in that because you're a people pleaser. So you could rewrite this book entirely around normal human behavior. And we all run up this debt. We all run up this debt all the time. So this is why I think it's something that can go much wider. And thank you for sharing that. I think it is that important. But for my purposes, publisher goes, who's the audience? Who's going to read it? Who's going to buy it? And the publishers want to sell copies. I'm not as interested, weirdly, as the publisher in selling copies. I want people to understand the concept because I want this thing to have an impact. So yeah, that's probably the difference. But I agree with you. For the purpose of this book, anyone who works in a business could take a lot from it. The other thing that I've heard is in terms of feedback, because the book's been out there now for a time of recording for 3 weeks or so, I'm starting to get feedback now from people saying, I thought you'd written a business book. This is just a really good read. This is not written like a business book, as I expect. It's not a textbook. It's, you probably get a sense if you've listened, you've got this far into listening to this, what I'm about. It's very narrative. It's very story-led. It's very equatable. And that's the point. I wasn't trying to write a business book. I don't know if I could. It's meant to just be, this is this idea. I want you to understand it. And you'll probably understand it if I can tell you some stories about people, because you'll go, yeah, that's me. Or that's my dad. Or that's someone I work with. Or that's everyone who I've ever worked with in any company ever. So that's the purpose of it. And I'm loving that people are saying that, because I tell people I've written a business book and I think they think, oh, well, this is going to sell six copies and go to a niche audience. But I think it's more important than that.
And there's nothing like reading a book that's relatable. There are so many business books that aren't relatable, and they might be great and they might be really important. But to read a book and to grasp the concepts and to walk away with takeaways, that is what I believe the world needs. And I think that's why Alison has Practical Inspiration Publishing as well as the title, because it is practical And it is inspiring. So I'll put some links in the show notes, Andy, to the book and to the self-assessment and everything. But this book deserves to be read, and I hope it is.
Well, thank you very much.
So, Andy, we're out of time. And I'm sure we could have kept going because I still had plenty of questions to ask you. But never mind. We can do it again sometime, perhaps. If people would like to connect with you, Andy, what's the best way of doing that?
Well, emotionaloverdraft.com is the website. If you want to find the book, I'm pretty sure most people on here know where to find a book. Amazon and all good bookshops, it's The Emotional Overdraft. I'm on Andy Brown Author on Instagram as well. But LinkedIn is where I do a lot of my work, and you can find me on there. There's a lot of articles. I write about this. I mean, I've written a book, but I've been writing about this topic for years and continue to produce a lot of information. So if people want to find out more, find me on LinkedIn.
Fantastic. Andy, thank you so much for your time and for the delightful conversation, actually. I think I completely forgot that we were recording at points, and that's a sign for me of a great conversation. So thank you for that.
It was terrific. Thank you, Susan.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed the paths we traversed on today's episode. If something rang through for you, be sure to let me know. Or maybe you can share this with someone in your life who would benefit from listening too. And if you enjoy helping others, I'd be so grateful if you would leave a review, so that people who might also be curious about their own life beyond the numbers can discover this podcast too.